The MMQB podcast is brought to you by the SeatGeek app, the easiest way to find a great deal, pay for your tickets, and get to your seat. Download the SeatGeek app and enter our code MMQB for $20 off your first tickets. We're also sponsored by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners and more payouts than any other site. Enter promo code THEMMQB at FanDuel.com for a bonus match of up to $200.
Have you ever gambled?
You mean like I go to like a casino or something?
Yeah.
The last time I went, I sat there and just read the Wikipedia on all the games because I was mesmerized. They're child games that grown men throw actual money at. So I don't gamble. And part of it also is because I thought if I win, I'll be embarrassed to tell people I won because I shouldn't have been playing in the first place.
And we don't need to get into why you don't watch the preseason.
Especially now that it's over and that it's even more irrelevant now.
Well, we thank you for being a part of the MMQB podcast. Now in its, is it the fifth week or sixth week that we've done this together?
I lost track around the third week. But really, for all intents and purposes, it's the first week because it's the first time we've got meaningful games to discuss.
Andy and I this week are going to break down all of the opening day matchups for the weekend. In future episodes, we promise we'll have guests, writers, NFL players, but this time we're really going to dive into week one. The first game that we wanted to talk about, Sunday night, 8:30 Eastern time, Giants at Cowboys. This is one of my favorite rivalry games in the NFL. I have yet to actually attend one of these, but I would say the NFC East in my mind has the most bitter rivalries in the whole league.
Yeah, I could see that. Who was the author? I think it was Mark Maskey who wrote a book about a year in the NFC East, and I love the title of it. It was called War Without Death.
I like that. Yeah. So, in thinking about the actual matchup, let's go first with Dallas has the ball. Dallas sort of underwent a offensive transformation last year. In 2013, they passed the ball 63% of the time when they were in the lead. That number dropped to 43% in 2014. Part of that is an all-world offensive line coming together. And I don't think you and I have talked about the Dallas offensive line. I'd be interested to hear what your thoughts on them and the reputation that they have now. But it seemed in a lot of ways, despite just missing the playoffs, they were able to compensate for whatever they were lacking on defense with a running game that chewed up a lot of the clock when they had the lead.
You know, it was a phenomenal running game last season, and I think it'll be even without DeMarco Murray, as I've said several times. I think it's going to be just as good this year with either Joseph Randall or a litany of different backs, and the reason is because of that offensive line. This is the best offensive line I've seen since I started watching film week in and week out. And in fact, it's not even close. It's certainly the best zone-blocking offensive line I've seen. Talent-wise, execution-wise, I don't know how else to be euphoric about it. I think Frederick's the best center in the league. Tyron Smith's the most athletic left tackle in the league. Zach Martin had a phenomenal rookie season. Even Doug Free was very good last year. Now Leo Collins is pushing Ronald Leary, so if there was a weak spot, it's going to be addressed soon, although I believe Leary's going to start this week. So it's an offensive line that you can scheme around, and you mentioned, Robert, how much they threw with the lead last season. They also ran the ball religiously on first down, which really tells you, first down play calling often tells you how a team really feels about its personnel, because the entire playbook's at your disposal there, and Dallas chose to line up in running formations and just straight hand the ball off.
Yeah, in fact, they ran the ball 71% of the time on first down, and they averaged 5.1 yards per carry. That second number is third in the NFL.
And that's why Tony Romo had the best season of his career, by the way. It sounds like an insult to say it, but Tony Romo has become a complementary player in this offense. Not only is he playing ahead in the down and distance, but he is playing with more of a play-action factor to him, and he's seeing different boxes and different looks, and you put Des Bryant outside along with a great running game, and then a security blanket like Jason Witten. And this is just a flat out difficult offense to defend because of the talent they have.
So where do the Giants stack up in terms of teams with a chance to stop these guys on offense?
Just looking at their roster, it doesn't look hopeful. Linebacker's been an issue for this team for several years, and it appears it will remain that way. Although I do like JT Thomas, the guy they got from Jacksonville, who I'm sure not many fans are familiar with. But JT Thomas isn't a difference maker, so to speak. So if the Giants aren't able to win along the front four, and it's an okay front four at best, I'd say, with Jason Pierre-Paul not in the lineup, then it's going to be a difficult matchup for him. You also factor in the question marks at safety, and we're talking about a formula for very shoddy run defense, quite frankly.
Now, when the Giants have the ball, obviously the marquee player is Odell Beckham, 91 catches last year, 1,305 yards, 12 touchdowns. People are expecting an even bigger year out of him. Sean Lee is back for Dallas at middle linebacker, though the last game that he played was in December 2013. You'll remember that he tore a ligament in his neck, not an injury that you hear much about. They keep him on the active roster for the entire season, hoping he can come back for the playoffs. They don't make the playoffs, and then that spring he tears his ACL.
Yeah, he hasn't been on the field in a while, and he had injury issues coming into the league, I believe, too.
Yeah, and a couple of all-pro seasons sprinkled in there, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's the key, really, because they need a nickel linebacker. I think Anthony Hitchens is a very good nickel linebacker, but nickel means having two linebackers on the field. And McClain is suspended right now, and even when he's back, he's really not very good in space and as a coverage guy. So Sean Lee's critical to what they're doing this season.
The Giants' offense averaged 332 yards a game last year during the first 7 weeks. And then really improved after the bye from week 9 on, 394 yards per game. Was there a transformation that was tangible that you could see something made a big difference?
I think they got a lot more. I mean, obviously they got a lot more comfortable in Ben McAdoo's system. It's a three receiver offense, and that's very different than playing out of base personnel with just two receivers on the field. Yeah, you face different defensive looks, and primarily you face convoluted defensive looks, because when defense is disguised, it's usually out of their nickel package, and that's what you get when you go three wide receivers. So I think it's a difficult task to transition to a three receiver offense, and that's why we saw them. They were very, very inconsistent early in the season, but once you get that and Eli Manning gets comfortable and Beckham was healthy in the second half of the season and really came into his own, now we're talking about some real firepower. And the other key was that they could run the ball, even power runs, out of those three receiver sets. So they really didn't compromise anything by adding the extra receiver and being speedier overall. It's the Giants. I'll be very curious to see this offense this season, because they might wind up being, we don't talk about them because of Chip Kelly and the Eagles and Dallas's run game. The Giants might wind up being the best offense in the NFC East this year, though.
Now, you and I haven't talked about this. Do we want to pick these games?
No, I absolutely do not. I think picking games is just a recipe for Twitter trolls. There's no upside to picking games.
Can we pick one game per week?
Sure. You want to pick Baltimore-Denver, which is the game we're about to do next?
Yeah, let's do that one. Okay.
Okay. I'll pick Baltimore and just get my part over with.
All right. Well, I was going to take the Broncos anyway. So
tell us why.
Well, let's talk about it first. A couple of issues in this game. One of the big suspensions, notably 26 players begin this season suspended. The big one for Denver is safety TJ Ward. Back in May 2014, he was charged with a misdemeanor assault for disturbing the peace. He allegedly threw a glass mug at a female bartender at a Denver strip club. So I guess it's been a year and a half later. That's now been addressed with the one-game suspension for conduct. Do you see that as a big loss for the Broncos going up against Joe Flacco?
It can be, because Denver's not particularly deep at safety, so maybe that's an issue. I'm surprised that we haven't seen a Robert Klemko feature story on all the suspensions. There's got to be some kind of social aspect you can take to this thing.
I think that they're just taking these minor issues a little bit more seriously, and not to say that throwing a glass at a bartender is minor, but I don't think that 5-6 years ago that's something that would have really moved the needle for the NFL.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that some of these suspensions are coming from incidences that took place a long time ago.
Right.
If you think about it, let's understand why the NFL suspends players, because it's not a moral thing. They want to paint it that way, but it's a business thing. It's bad for business when the players look like thugs. Would you agree with that?
Oh, certainly.
So if I find it interesting that they're dragging up these old issues. I'd forgotten all about T.J. Ward getting in trouble, as I'm sure many people outside of Denver, maybe even inside of Denver, had forgotten as well. And so it's interesting that they would suspend him this long after the incident. And there's been other ones as well where it's come down like that.
Well, I think there's
I'm not criticizing the league. I'm just saying it's interesting that they're not wanting to bury these stories more.
I think there's two sides of it, because yes, it's a PR move in a lot of ways, because you want fans to know that players are being held accountable for this kind of behavior. But I think even more than that, it's about kind of trying to change the culture to where even if it's a year, 14 months, 16 months later, players know that eventually they're going to have to pay for, whatever transgressions they've made. So I'm always cynical about, the NFL and why they do certain things, but I do appreciate the fact that even 15 months later, in the case of T.J. Ward, they will go ahead and suspend him at least a game.
Yeah. You want to tell us real quick why you like Denver?
Well, I think the big thing is Peyton Manning's success early in the season. Always gets off to a fast start. I don't have stats on how many openers he's won, but I remember that being a big thing in Indianapolis. I think he had a string of them. Baltimore allowed 72 more passing yards per game on the road last season than at home. That was the largest gap in the NFL. You have Peyton Manning in his first 9 games in 2014, 29 touchdowns, 7 interceptions. In his final 7 games, 10 touchdowns, 8 interceptions. So we know that this is the time when Peyton really turns it on. This being his last season, I would be shocked if he lost the opener.
Do you think this is his last season?
I do think this is the last season, yeah.
I think he's got one more after this one.
Yeah, maybe.
Total speculation.
Oh, yeah,
no idea.
Same here. But I think this is his last effective season, at least.
Remember, Baltimore went into Denver a few years ago as the defending champs and got their doors blown off. And it was by Manning. I believe, was that Manning's? I guess it was Manning's second year in Denver, because it was a 2013 season. The numbers you pose are interesting. I wonder why that is with Baltimore being on the road. If that's, it might just be an outlier stat. I think I picked the Ravens for the game just because, out of principle, I feel like in these week one games, I go with whoever I picked early in the season. And for those who listened to our podcast last week, I picked Baltimore to win the Super Bowl. So, I don't know. Are we done with the picking game thing, though? Have we satisfied it enough?
Yeah, well, later off the podcast, we'll talk about some money behind this thing.
Okay. That sounds ominous for me.
You don't like to bet? Have you ever gambled?
Every time I've gambled, you mean like I go to like a casino or something?
Yeah. What do you play?
The last time I went, I sat there and just read the Wikipedia on all the games, because I was mesmerized by how many people were stupid enough to play them. They're child games that grown men throw actual money at. So I don't gamble. And part of it also is because I thought if I win, I'll be embarrassed to tell people I won, because I shouldn't have been playing in the first place.
Well, I don't go and play any of the games that are like based on luck. I go play poker where I'm playing against other people.
Yeah, and I'm not a skilled enough poker player to do that. And I don't own any sunglasses. You go in there and these guys, those should not be allowed in poker.
I've never sat at a table with somebody wearing sunglasses.
I don't know why they allow it. Like if you take away the poker face, like poker, like only like 20% of poker is left to exist. Like the whole fun of poker is the poker face, and sunglasses wipe it out. Anyway, Green Bay, Chicago. Are you going to the Green Bay Chicago game?
No. Despite the fact that I live in Chicago, I'm going down to St. Louis for the Seahawks Rams game, and I'll tell you why we're not going to this one, because I think we know what's going to happen. this is probably the most lopsided, quote-unquote, rivalry in the NFL. Aaron Rodgers, Packers quarterback versus the Bears in his career, is 11-3 with 3,448 yards, 31 touchdowns, and 8 interceptions. Cutler versus the Packers in his career is 1-10 with 57 completion percentage, 2,456 yards, 14 touchdowns, and 21 interceptions. So it would be a pretty big shock if this ended up being any kind of good game.
Yeah, I know the office I go to every day, the guy in the office next to me is the creator cheese grater heads that the Bears fans have started to wear.
Cheese head.
And no, cheese grater heads. He's a Bears fan, and it's like a cheese grater as the head, as the hat.
Oh, really? I'd never seen that.
It was on Monday Night Football a few years ago. I think 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay.
And anyway, he's not going to this game. He goes to every single Bears Packers game. So, I get the reasoning for that. I think there's not, you know, I'll be real curious to see, and I don't mean to be negative, but I'll be curious, and this will be a good chance to highlight it, how bad this Chicago defense is in the new scheme, because I can't remember the last time I saw a team have such gaping holes in their personnel based on the scheme they want to run. This team was built entirely to play a 4-3 over the years, a zone 4-3, the most vanilla of all 4-3s, and now they're going to more of a multiple 3-4 under Vic Fangio. You can't overhaul an entire roster in 1 year, and they haven't come close even if they tried. So I'll be curious to see just how bad it is, quite frankly.
Yeah. Well, let's keep running down the list here because we want to get to all of the games going on this weekend. The fourth game, Tennessee Titans at Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Our own Jenny Vrentis of the MMQB will be covering this one. Obviously, it's hugely significant because we've got the number one and number two picks, both rookie quarterbacks going up against each other, Marcus Mariota versus Jameis Winston. In your mind, which of these guys has more success early given their, you know, the offenses that they're being surrounded with?
I would say Mariota because he will be harder to play against. We know what Jameis Winston is. The NFL has seen pocket passers before. When mobile quarterbacks enter the league, though, there is an adjustment period for defenders. The tendencies for those QBs are different. Mariota's a compact thrower, which I think helps. He's got that little bit of that Russell Wilson factor as a throwing motion. And so there's a quickness to his game overall. And when you factor in quickness with unfamiliarity, that's the chance you have for splash plays, so to speak. Winston, you've got a guy with a little bit of a slower windup who's developing behind a subpar offensive line. That's the formula for a growing experience, we'll call it euphemistically. So even though I think Winston's the better prototype over the long haul, if we're talking immediately, I'd take the mobile quarterback because he can do more things and you can show more that you haven't shown with him.
One thing that I wanted to get your take on is the running back situation in Tampa Bay. I remember a couple of years ago, we thought Doug Martin was kind of the vanguard of the new generation of young, talented running backs. And now, you know, he probably went like in the 30th round of my fantasy draft. What happened to him in Tampa Bay?
Well, he obviously has had the injuries. He was, you know, I watched a lot of him as a rookie, and I struggled with him. I wasn't sure what he was. A lot of his stats came again. Like, I remember he played a bad Raiders defense in the middle of the season, and he had over, I think he had like 250 yards rushing or something like that. He had some inflated statistics in the middle of the year that kind of gave me pause.
And we're talking about having 2 years ago, right?
Maybe. I think it's 3 years ago. It's 2012. Yeah. It was his rookie season when he had I think he finished with 1,200 yards rushing. Mm-hmm. But the vast majority of his rushing yards were in the second half of that season. That was in a true I formation type running game with a fullback, lead blockers, all that stuff, which they might do some of here under Dirk Cutter now still in Tampa Bay. So that was part A with Martin. The other head scratching part B was that even his bad games, though, he still looked good to me at times. I could see the skill set. His skills did not always match his productivity, and that was in good and bad ways. Here's what Martin is. He's a compact runner with good short area quickness and a little bit more lateral agility than you would guess. Now, the question is, how much help does he need around him? Because if I don't think he's a guy, he's not Jamal Charles or LeSean McCoy, where he's going to consistently create his own yards. But I think if you give him a little bit of daylight, he can turn that into a lot of daylight. We just haven't seen that because a guy like that needs a good offensive line in front of him. They haven't had that in Tampa Bay. And then you never know how injuries impact each guy. And in his case, he's had several.
Yeah. Before we move on,
what's interesting, Robert, by the way, is this is a good reminder. Teams tell you how they feel about their guys by who they draft. And 2 years after they had Martin, they still drafted Charles Sims in the third round. Mm-hmm. Now, it's clearly someone in Tampa Bay who had Martin at one point, the previous regime, the guys in charge, they decided that they weren't as comfortable with Martin after what they'd seen from 2 years. So I think the Bucs are having questions just like we're having questions.
Yeah. If you're a fan of either one of these teams, I have some required reading for you. Kevin Clark of the Wall Street Journal this week published a story which I thought was one of the best in the run-up to the first week of the season regarding how NFL executives, coaches, talent evaluators feel that we've reached a breaking point in terms of the relationship between the NFL and college football when the quarterbacks make that next step, because so few of them are prepared to do simple things like understand what a cover three or a cover two looks like because of these simplified college offenses that are about winning and not so much about developing the passers. So that's something to read and keep in mind as you see these two players who in the NFL have nothing but a preseason under their belt before they get thrown into the fire. I think in a perfect world, you either have an NFL minor league that all rookie quarterbacks spend some time in, or you take a Jameis Winston or a Marcus Mariota and you let him sit on the bench for 8 games behind a capable veteran, regardless of whether or not you're struggling during that stretch of games.
Yeah. Well, the reason these college teams are playing to win rather than to develop programs is because coaches get fired quickly. And the reason that these rookies come in ill-prepared but they get thrown onto the field is for that same reason. Coaches get fired quickly. And so the coach thinks, well, I need to play the guy that the GM, who also hired me, just drafted. So that's a conundrum. But the whole college quarterback thing, I think we're on to something there, because the gap between college and the NFL is widening, and it's most evident at quarterback.
Yeah. Our fifth game of the week, Indianapolis Colts at the Buffalo Bills. This is a matchup where I think the Colts will look to break a stout Buffalo defense. Here's a big one-on-one. Anytime T.Y. Hilton lines up across from rookie cornerback Ronald Darby, I think that's a matchup the Colts are likely to win.
And I feel like a buffoon because I wrote in my Bills preview, and I think I wrote it in the magazine too, I didn't understand at first why they drafted Darby. Now, clearly the Bills had better medical information on Leotis McKelvin than I had, because McKelvin's out, he's had a setback, and he's turning 30, and who knows what his future holds. But bottom line is, Darby is now cast into a significant role for them. Nickell Roby's probably going to stay in the nickel slot, where he's excellent, and that's where you want him. What I'm wondering, though, is will Stephon Gilmore follow T.Y. Hilton around? And I think Gilmore's that caliber a guy. The question, though, is he that style of cornerback? He's a guy, when I say that caliber of guy, I think he's a guy you can put on number one receivers on an island. However, he's bigger and lankier. Darby's 5'11", 195. I haven't seen a lot of him, but presumably he's got better quickness than the bigger Gilmore. So I'll be interested to see who matches up to who in Buffalo, or if they match up anybody at all.
One big name that keeps coming up, though I'm not convinced he will be a big name at the end of the season, is Frank Gore. He averaged at least 4 yards per carries in all 10 seasons he spent in San Francisco. They you know, are ready to move on. Indianapolis picks him up. Indianapolis in Andrew Luck's career has not been able to land on that long-term starting running back. Frank Gore isn't that, but do you believe from what you saw last year that he can contribute something on a consistent basis for, you know, 16 weeks?
I think if you limit his snaps, although I've been saying that about Frank Gore. In fact, the Niners, I know back in 2012, had plans to split Frank Gore's snaps with Carlos Hyde. And those never came to fruition because Gore was simply too good to take off the field. That kind of repeated itself in 2013 and 2014. So I've been thinking Frank Gore, based on his style of play, the injuries he had early in his career. I mean, goodness, the guy's 32 now. I've been thinking he was going to wash up a while ago, and he just hasn't. So I've almost become hesitant to bet against him. I'll say this. I was very surprised that they got rid of Dan Heron. And maybe there was something going on that I don't know about, a health injury or something like that. But I thought Heron gave them very good pass protection last year. And if you'd had him on the roster, you could take Gore out in your third down packages and save his reps that way. Well, Heron's gone now. And Josh Robinson, the sixth round rookie's on the roster. And Vic Ballard, who at one point was that long-term running back for Andrew Luck, but injuries have wiped him out the last couple years. And he's been battling, I believe, a hamstring it is lately. But anyway, Vic Ballard's only the only other running back on the roster. So it looks like Gore's going to wind up having to play all three downs. And if that's the case, then I do become hesitant about the 32-year-old running back for 16 games playing all three downs.
As a fan of the entire league, this is a game that I'll be paying attention to, you know, because of that running back situation. If Andrew Luck is going to take that next step, I think they do need a consistent option there, a guy who can play all three downs. I'm not convinced that Heron or Frank Gore is that guy. I think it's a position they end up drafting for next year, though I think many would like to see them focus their early round picks on the defense. The other game we wanted to talk about, Dolphins at Washington. With the Dolphins' strong front seven, do you believe that Washington could potentially flourish against a questionable secondary with Kirk Cousins starting at quarterback?
When you put it that way, not necessarily, because I think in order for Washington to flourish this year, it's going to have to start with the running game. And that means pounding the ball out of a zone ground game, which they're built to do, and they drafted Brandon Scherff to plug him in and even fortify what was already a decent offensive line. They're going to have to play that way, get Alfred Morris on the perimeter where he's at his best, and then that from there you set up your play-action game, which limits a quarterback's reads, demands that he gets the ball out on time, and really simplifies the game for him. And also you throw out of base personnel, so you're throwing against base personnel. I think that's the simplified approach Washington has to take. Now the problem is, can you run the ball against Miami's front? It's an excellent front seven. The Ndamukong Suh factor makes what was already a good front four, already probably a great front four even greater. And it's a team that the Dolphins have always been very good early in the season in run defense. So I think that's where this game is won and lost. I can't tell you how it's going to go, but I'm not overly optimistic about Washington's ability to run on a Miami front. Mm-hmm.
When Miami has the ball, you've got Lamar Miller starting at running back, a guy that some have high hopes for this season as a complement to Ryan Tannehill. Washington, interestingly, and you wouldn't have known this just by watching a handful of their games, but they allowed just 300-yard rushes last season, and twice it was DeMarco Murray.
I think that's partly because everybody was throwing on him, though.
Yeah, but even when you have a losing season, you expect to allow some 100-yard rushers because the other team is running out the clock at the end of the game, right?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Washington's got a good front seven, and it's a tough one to run against because Terrence Knighton and Steven Paya come in and join that defensive front, which was already, I think, effective. The question is, what will they do about mismatches in defense, in pass defense? The issue under Jim Haslett, who's no longer there, now the new D coordinator is Joe Barry, but the issue under Haslett was that they always played two linebacker nickel personnel against any passing formation. And so if teams brought in four receivers, which is something I think Miami, who's a three receiver offense, I think they'll be willing to go four receivers at times. If they had that, they were stuck with the linebacker on a wide receiver at some point. And teams continuously picked them apart with this. I mean, the Colts killed them with it, I remember. Streak routes down the middle of the field working the linebackers. So I'm eager to see what amendments have been made to the scheme. I expect more zone concepts and not just matchup zone, but pure zone stuff to help to get guys more in help coverage, because they don't have very many good, in fact, they don't have any really good corners, and they don't have very many corners coming off the bench to help them either.
Heading all the way out to Arizona, we've got the Saints at the Cardinals. You know, I was browsing Twitter yesterday, and I saw an odds list of coaches likely to be fired after the 2015 season. And these things are, you know, more entertaining than meaningful at this point in the season. But it was interesting to me to see Sean Payton, number 10 on that list. I don't think I could see him getting fired after this year, but maybe two more years of middling around the NFC South, and it could happen.
Well, the question is, does when Drew Brees is done, is Sean Payton done? Do you think that would be the case?
I don't think
I don't mean Sean Payton retiring, but like, you know, the organization feels, hey, now's our time to move on and redefine ourselves.
Well, they've been together for 10 years. I believe they're entering their 10th season. Also involved in that first season of Brees were Marcus Colston, Jahri Evans, and Zach Strief. All those guys were on the team and still are on the team 10 years later. I do think that Sean Payton would get a shot with another young quarterback, but I think he would be on a short leash.
On a short leash with the next team he's on, you mean, or the short leash with the Saints?
The short leash with the Saints.
Yeah, I could, you know, that I could see that. I would say it's more the approach, the Saints' entire modus operandi is on a short leash if this season doesn't go well. Mm-hmm. They've been built so heavily on offense, and GM Mickey Loomis made it clear this offseason, both in what he said and in his actions, that they want to balance that out and become a good defensive team, a better defensive team. If they toil around 8-8 again this year and rank high in offense but low in defense, do they reshuffle the deck completely? I haven't given that a lot of thought. That's an interesting one, though. To me, in my mind, Sean Payton's just been one of those untouchable coaches, because there aren't three or four better play callers in the league than Sean Payton.
Yeah. If you look specifically at this matchup with Arizona, do you believe that the Saints can generate a pass rush with their current personnel, minus, of course, Junior Gallette, and take advantage of Cardinals' offensive line that is without Ayupati?
No, I do not believe that. I'm not confident in the Saints' pass rush in any game this season. We'll find out a lot, though, this week, because Arizona does more with empty sets than any team in the league. And when you go empty, an empty set, no running back is in the backfield, it's just a QB, that means you've got only five guys to five offensive linemen blocking. When you do that, there's no help for any of the linemen, and you are inviting blitzes that way. So if the Saints can't generate some kind of pressure, or if they don't even attempt to, and maybe they'll play coverage against empty, I don't know. But my point is, we're talking about a team in Arizona that has okay personnel and only okay along the offensive line going up against the Saints team that we have questions about the pass rush. We're going to learn a lot about one of these teams and one of these directions this week.
The other game, before we take a quick break here, Chiefs at Texans. The Chiefs are now optimistic about Don Terry Poe's status for week one. I think he was an all-pro defensive tackle is a cog on that defense, and one of the main reasons losing him last season was a big reason that they struggled in some spots. How big is it to have him back?
It's enormous, because I think we talked about this like on our first or second podcast.
Yeah.
The Chiefs do so much out of their dime personnel grouping. Who you have on the field is really important, you know, the players you put on the field. And when you go dime, you've got six defensive backs. You have to be able to contend against the run out of that grouping, out of that personnel package. And with Don Terry Poe in the lineup, you can, because he can play two gaps. He can move opponents into the backfield. I mean, he's a monster. If he's out of the lineup, then you're significantly limited and you might not even want to play dime. You might just go nickel or even stay in your base. So how they go with Poe, I think that it changes everything. If he's in, I think it's a good defense. If he's out, I think it's an average defense. And this is the last coaching staff I'd want to go against if I've got a weakness that I'm trying to hide, because Houston is extremely well coached. The play calling's excellent. And I'm sure Bill O'Brien would give any amount of money within reason to find out for sure whether Poe's going to be in or out of the lineup, because that's how they'll build their game plan.
Yeah. I don't have high hopes for Houston in this game, just because I think that Kansas City's offense got more diverse in getting Travis Kelce back from injury, adding Jeremy Maclin. I think the defense got healthy and they're back in top five form just after watching them this preseason. And we don't need to get into why you don't watch the preseason.
Especially now that it's over and that it's even more irrelevant now.
The person that I really believe in the least is who the Texans are starting at quarterback, which is Brian Hoyer. Last season as a starter in Cleveland, goes 7-6, completes just over half of his passes, throws 12 interceptions with 11 touchdowns. He is way below the Mendoza line for quarterbacks in the NFL, and I think that he's not really nothing more this season than a placeholder for whoever Bill O'Brien drafts in the first round next year.
Are you going to rip the Texans and specifically Brian Hoyer every week on the show? And if you are, that's fine. I'm just curious.
Well, maybe they'll bench him and start somebody else, and then I'll rip that guy.
Okay, that sounds fair. That's or totally unfair, but sounds like that's what you're going to do.
Before we move on here, could you tell the listeners about SeatGeek?
Yeah, it's the best way to find an amazing deal on football tickets. It's the SeatGeek app. So when you use our code MMQB, you'll get $20 off your first ticket buy. The SeatGeek app takes less than a minute to download. It's free on iPhone and Android smartphones. And what it does, it's aggregating from big ticket sites. So just like when you search for flights and hotels online, SeatGeek pulls in ticket options from hundreds of sellers, create a one-stop shop for sports and concert tickets. They also have this great feature called Deal Score. It ranks every ticket on the market with a 1 to 100 value, scores and plots the best deals on a color-coded interactive map of the venue. So you don't have to keep pulling up different stadium charts and finding out what the best deals are. SeatGeek app does that for you. The app makes the ticket buying process seamless, easy, and safe. So to redeem your promo code and save $20 on tickets, download the free SeatGeek app today, enter the promo code MMQB in the app, and SeatGeek will send you $20 once you've made your first SeatGeek purchase.
Very nice job, Andy.
Thank you. Yeah, that was my first SeatGeek call for the year.
How did it feel?
It was all right. It was, you know, I mean, I think the app's outstanding. The process will get only smoother from here for me. You want to talk? Will you tell us why, getting back on games, why you're going to Seattle and St. Louis? And last time you went to St. Louis, didn't you get like arrested for protesting or something like that?
Yeah, I was briefly detained in Ferguson because, well, I wasn't protesting. I was covering the protests, Andy. You know that.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I do know that. How long were you detained for on that? You tweeted it, right? You tweeted it.
I live tweeted it. It was literally like 10 minutes. We stood around with the Missouri state police captain, and he kind of decided what to do with us, me and a couple journalists who had, I guess, strayed a little bit too close to the action. And one of them was this British guy who just wasn't listening to what the police were trying to tell us to do. And so they just handcuffed all of us. And then me and the other guy.
Obviously that you were cuffed in front, not from the behind, right?
Right.
If you were tweeting from behind,
oh, well, no.
Then that's the story.
I tweeted, we're being arrested now. And then I put my phone in my pockets and then they cuffed me.
Oh, so you weren't sitting there tweeting the whole time, you know, hey, I'm still arrested or whatever you tweet
no,
when you're standing.
No, it wasn't like that.
Okay, so you just live tweeted, I'm being arrested now. Very good. Any plans for another protest coverage from you? Is there anything to cover in St. Louis?
No, you know what? I was going to go down there early, like on Friday, and go check out Ferguson because there was a barbecue place. I believe it was called Red's. And it was on this main drag that was, you know, constantly the center of all the violence and protesting. And it eventually got burned down by looters. And so I believe it's back open. And I always said, you know, next time I'm back in St. Louis, I'm going to try the barbecue.
Okay. Well, so you'll give that a shot. Why are you going to this game, though? What drew you to this besides your best buddy Richard Sherman playing in it?
Well, the big thing to me actually concerned Sherman and that defense. You have a Seahawks team that is fresh off probably the most devastating and disappointing Super Bowl loss that a team can go through, losing on the final play like that on an interception at the goal line. And then you have a bit of a transformation in the defensive backfield, which was one of the strong suits of this team. Cam Chancellor holding out of his contract may not even be available to play safety. Earl Thomas hasn't hit anybody in a year with his shoulder injury. And Byron Maxwell, the free agent corner this past offseason, signs a long-term deal with Philadelphia for more money than Seattle was willing to offer after having paid Richard Sherman a great deal of money last offseason. So now they have Kerry Williams starting at corner, and their nickel corner, I believe, is between Jeremy Burley and couple other guys that I have.
Well, there's you mean Marcus Burley, and then there's who was pretty good for them last year, and then there's Ty Smith. The guy I'm curious, are you familiar with Thurald Simon at all? Has your buddy Sherman talked about him to you?
I've met him. I don't believe that he's even played a good number of snaps in his career.
Well, he was cast in the lineup a few times when Maxwell was out last season, and I thought he was very good. He's long-armed. He was physical. He was certainly inconsistent. I'm sure Seahawks fans aren't huge on him because they're used to perfection at the position. But I would not be surprised, and we're not going to see it this week, but I would not be surprised if Thurald Simon somehow worked his way into the lineup on a regular basis before the season's over. I am not a big Kerry Williams fan, and he's the guy they brought in for Maxwell. They essentially swapped cornerbacks with Philadelphia and saved some money. But you're right. This is a weakened secondary, and Chancellor out, you know, also hurts the locker room, supposedly. The question, though, do you think that we'll see it exposed in this game? Because they're going against a St. Louis team that has made it very clear they want to pound the rock, although it's a team that's also without its running backs, Trey Mason and Todd Gurley, for this one. Mason's, I guess, is a game-time decision.
Yeah, no, I don't think it'll be exposed at all. But I think that a lot of times we go to games and we try to draw conclusions and extrapolate results over the course of a season fairly and unfairly in certain cases. A lot of people will be watching this game, myself included, to see if Seattle or St. Louis has any measure of success against this pass defense, because if they do, then you say, I don't know if they would have done anything against the Seattle defense last year, the way it was constructed. So how's Seattle then going to look when they go up against some of the heavyweights in the NFC, the Packers, almost, you figure, inevitably in the playoffs?
Yeah. And you know what's occurring to me is I have to find an assignment now, because Peter King called me last week and told me I'm writing about this, Seattle and
yeah.
St. Louis.
Yeah.
So good. Maybe I ought to get your ticket.
They're going to talk to you about that. You're bumped onto something else.
Yeah. Oh, bumped. Thank you. That's a great way to put it. I appreciate the terminology. It'll probably be Denver-Baltimore, which is fine for me. One's an early window game. One's a late window game anyway. Whatever the team needs, I'm up for it.
You're the man.
I'm the man. Okay. We all know Peter's a man, but I appreciate that.
Moving right along. Detroit Lions go to visit the San Diego Chargers in San Diego, which is beautiful this time of year. I can't believe
This time of year. What time of year is it not so beautiful?
It's always amazing. You know, I got my most recent tattoo in San Diego on at the beach.
Your most recent tattoo. Yeah. I've told you those tattoos are going to hurt your career at some point.
Ah, whatever.
What's it of?
I don't feel I don't feel comfortable disclosing that.
Are you serious? You don't feel wow.
No, no. It's of you know, the Join or Die political cartoon from 17.
Wait a minute. You got the you got that so you've got Klemko's got the Join or Die political cartoon, which was pretty much like a gang member initiation thing from hundreds and hundreds of years ago, as I understand it.
If the gang, the gang you're referring to is America, then yeah.
Yeah, well, Join or Die. He got, so you're telling me you got that Revolutionary War tattoo on the West Coast in San Diego?
Isn't that what this country's all about? It's the great melting pot.
I'm surprised you trusted the guy on the beach to give you that tattoo.
Oh, tattoo artists are usually pros. I mean, they can kind of adapt to whatever you ask him to do.
Did he know what it was about? Like, did he have any idea what this thing was about? You showed him a picture, I'm sure.
Yeah, no, he didn't remember it from history class.
Okay, well, God, that is, I would not have done that. If I'm getting something tattooed on me, I want my tat, and I want the tattoo artist to not only be familiar with it, but have like a degree in history studies.
Well, why does he need to have a connection? Do you realize that they're not free-handing it? They make a temporary tattoo, they put it on you, and then they do the ink over that.
No, I do not realize that at all. I have never gotten a tattoo. Is that the case?
All right, back to football. In your mind, is it safe to say that there is no, you know, number one wide receiver in San Diego, and that either Keenan Allen or Malcolm Floyd or Johnson could potentially lead the team in receiving on any given week? Or is there a guy in your mind out of those three that emerges as the clear number one option for Phil Rivers?
I think it's both, which sounds weird, but Rivers is a good enough quarterback. He's not reliant on any single receiver, certainly. And this is a diverse offense. It's very well coordinated and executed. And it's primarily a three-receiver offense. There's that theme again, three wide receivers, and it's going to be a power-running offense out of three receivers. A very modern approach to football with an excellent quarterback. I think, so I say it's both, because when you take that approach, you're going to take the best matchup and capitalize on it if you're Phillip Rivers. Having said that, I think clearly Keenan Allen's the best of these wide receivers. He's a better version of Stevie Johnson, who Keenan Allen actually told me when I was at Chargers training camp that he watched Stevie Johnson film quite extensively early in his career, and he hadn't even told Stevie Johnson that yet.
Wow.
Don't you think he'd go up to him like the first day and just like, and, you know, welcome him to the team and say, by the way, I watched your film?
Well, that's like, you know, going up to a girl and being like, hey, I've look through your Facebook pictures.
No, it's not. because you don't have any like interest in Stevie Johnson. Presumably, he doesn't want to make a life with Stevie Johnson. That's nothing like that.
Before we breeze through these last few games, I wanted to tell you guys about FanDuel. The NFL is finally back in action, and it's your last chance to join FanDuel for the opening weekend. Now you can play with up to $200 in bonus cash with our code, the MMQB. I mean, our sponsors are just giving away money for the MMQB.
Yeah, yeah.
You've probably heard of FanDuel somewhere before. Here's what it's about. It's the leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners and more payouts than any other site. They will pay you over $75 million a week this football season. I'm sorry, not you, but they'll pay the fans.
All of you. They'll pay all of you.
Yeah, collective. The royal you. We all love fantasy football, but a lot of fans miss out because the whole season is just too much of a time commitment. FanDuel does away with all that, and I really sympathize with that because I do not like playing fantasy football when I'm losing around week 12.
Yeah, no, I've quit on leagues before too. It's a brilliant idea, and the New Yorker did a really in-depth article on FanDuel a few months ago, basically saying this is the future of fantasy football.
Yeah.
We'll look back and wonder why we never played it this way to begin with all the time.
Yeah. So go to FanDuel.com and click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Use the code TheMMQB and sign up now. There's a special offer for new users. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it with up to $200 that gets earned as you play. That's a bonus of up to $200. The offer is only good for the first 50 people that use the code TheMMQB today. So don't get left out. If you're listening to this on Sunday, you got left out. Don't forget, the code is TheMMQB. FanDuel.com. Try it out today. Okay.
All right, Klemko, we got three games left on Sunday, right? We got Bengals, Raiders, Panthers, Jags, and Browns, Jets. And I assume, no disrespect to those teams, but we kind of want to go through those a little quickly, maybe?
Yeah, this is the home stretch.
This is the home stretch before we talk about the Monday night games. You know, every time I see Bengals, Raiders, all I can think about on first impression is Carson Palmer, for, even though he's not there anymore. Like, I just think, oh, couple of failed Carson Palmer teams.
That's one.
I do. I think bad Carson Palmer trade, although I guess it worked out all right for Cincinnati.
Yeah.
In the end, yeah.
Yeah. With these games where I don't feel like either team has legitimate deep playoff hopes or Super Bowl hopes, and no, you know, no offense to the Bengals, but I think that they're in a really good division where the Steelers and the Ravens are probably the favorites. I like to watch in these games individual players that are dominant, you know, guys that catch your eye, like Khalil Mack. Last year, he rushed the passer on 85% of the other team's passing snaps, and in that time, he accumulated the second most hurries among 4-3 linebackers, just behind Von Miller. Now, everybody knows who Von Miller is, but not too many people know who Khalil Mack is. Why is that?
Yeah, because he didn't get the sacks, and he's not going to be a 4-3 linebacker anymore. He'll be people like to call it the Leo defensive end. He's basically the weak side defensive end in Jack Del Rio's 4-3 scheme. He might, you know, moonlight at linebacker a few times for diversity's sake, but Khalil Mack's future and even his present, which are both very bright, takes place at the weak side defensive end. And by lining up on the weak side opposite the tight end, he's going to get a lot of one-on-one matchups. And I'm telling you, Klemko, there might be one or two tackles in the league that can hold their own with Khalil Mack for an entire game one-on-one. This guy's a top five defensive end. If not right now, then certainly by the end of this season.
I remember a couple of drafts ago when he came out, you had Jadeveon Clowney going number one to the Texans, and this guy was a number one prospect coming out of high school, the clear number one for a lot of people coming out of college, after what was a spectacular but somewhat spotty college career. And then everybody said, you know, big drop off, and then here's Khalil Mack, University of Buffalo, two-star recruit. If you go to his Rivals.com profile page, it doesn't even have his picture. The guys at Rivals didn't even go out to his high school and get a headshot of the guy or email the coach. They just threw him up there, two-star, commits to Buffalo, becomes a second pick. And I think if you asked any team right now who they'd rather have, they'd probably say Khalil Mack.
Yeah, I would agree. Panthers at Jaguars. Despite allowing the sixth most rushing yards last year, Jacksonville's defense really had only gave up 4.1 yards a carry to opposing backs, which was 12th best in the league. I bring that up because I think we can all agree, in order to beat Carolina, you take away the running game. Any hopes for Jacksonville this week and able to do that? Are you familiar with the Jags at all? Because they come from a lot of those Seahawks connections, and I know you're very familiar with the Seahawks.
I don't have a lot of familiarity with Jacksonville. The problem with, you know, covering the league and traveling every week to at least one and sometimes two cities is that you don't end up seeing a lot of Jags games unless you're watching writing about the team that they're playing against. I do have some familiarity with Carolina, and I think that they're in pretty rough shape. If Jacksonville is going to eke out 4 or 5 wins this season, I think this is a pretty good place to start. You have Michael Orr starting at left tackle, who was on the downslope of an underwhelming career. You have Devin Funchess, who was the de facto number one wide receiver after Kelvin Benjamin goes out. He's now potentially out for week one with an injury of his own. So Philly Brown and Ted Ginn and Jericho Cotchery are your three wide receivers. That is a combination that you would expect of Jacksonville, not a team that had hoped to compete in the NFC South in Carolina.
Yeah, and you mentioned Michael Orr, downslope of kind of an underwhelming career. I'm real curious to watch Luke Jokel this year because he's been underwhelming to me. In fact, he's been very disappointing, and Jacksonville's going to have a problem at left tackle if he doesn't improve.
Browns, Jets. In your mind, these are two strong football teams, no?
Yeah, no, I think these are – I don't know if I'd say strong teams, but – I don't think these teams are as bad as people think. I think there's a little bit of a laughing stock element to them because one of them has Johnny Manziel and the other one had their quarterback get punched out, among other reasons. But these are two teams that can play man coverage and have a lot of designer blitzes. That's a formula for a lot of 13-10 type of games. And if you're in a 13-10 game, then your quarterback problems aren't as big as they appear to be on the surface. You can eke by with those issues. So I'm curious to see. In fact, we might be looking at the two best pure cover corners in the league in this matchup with, you know, Joe Hayden and certainly Darrell Revis.
One player I'll be watching in that game is Leonard Williams, number 3 pick in the draft, yes?
Number 6 pick in the draft. It was expected to go number 3. It went number 6.
Yeah. My mind is still in mock draft mode. I didn't even pay attention to the actual draft.
Yeah, no, that happens to me too sometimes. Is you get so into the mock drafts before the draft that when I'm writing about these guys months later, I forget where they actually wound up going.
Yeah. So the last game we're going to get into, the last two games, the Monday night doubleheader, these are a couple of good ones. We've got the Philadelphia Eagles first at the Atlanta Falcons, and then the Minnesota Vikings at the San Francisco 49ers. In your mind, is Byron Maxwell the kind of player that will be asked or should be asked to shadow a Julio Jones, or is he going to be limited to one side of the field?
I would imagine he'll be limited to one side of the field because that's how he played in Seattle, and that's how they played their cornerbacks last year in Philadelphia. So I would think he's going to just step right into where Kerry Williams was as the right cornerback. That's exactly how he should play. The question is, do you play him in the slot? And I think the answer could be yes to that because they got rid of Boykin, and I'm not sure who else. I guess maybe they drop Walter Thurman into the slot. Maybe the safety in the base package becomes a slot defender. Nolan Carroll, maybe they've liked what they've seen. I'm not so sure we're going to see Maxwell on the perimeter all the time like we did in Seattle, though. I wouldn't be surprised if we see him move into the slot at some point for them.
Here's why I really like the Eagles in this game. Last year, they limited opposing running backs to 3.7 yards per carry. That was the fourth best in the league. They add Kiko Alonso in a swap for LeSean McCoy with the Bills in the offseason, and he's playing linebacker now. In Atlanta, the running back competition, I believe, is between Devontae Freeman and Tevin Coleman.
And Coleman won it. Coleman won it, but they'll probably split the carries ultimately anyway, I would think.
I think both of them will wind up being underwhelming rookie seasons, and especially early against stout defenses like this one. So if we were picking games, which we're not, I would pick the Eagles.
All right, well, and if we were picking games, which we're not, I'd probably pick the Eagles as well because that run defense you mentioned, it's phenomenal. And the reason why, Alonzo helps, certainly. And Alonzo alongside Michael Kendricks, that's the fastest inside linebacking duo in the league, assuming Alonzo's the guy he was before his knee injury. But the reason why this is such a good run defense is because that front three is stupendous. It's Fletcher Cox, a penetrator, Cedric Thornton, one of the best double team attackers in the league, and Benny Logan, who's fast becoming one of the league's better nose tackles.
All right, final game, home stretch here, Minnesota Vikings at San Francisco 49ers. This is obviously fascinating because whether or not it's a good game or a blowout or what have you, so many storylines. Adrian Peterson coming back for the Minnesota Vikings. Teddy Bridgewater, who a lot of people are really excited about, based on last year's performance combined with what seemed like some improvement shown in the preseason. And then you have the San Francisco 49ers, who have probably undergone the worst preseason, the worst offseason that a team can go through, in recent NFL memory. What's the body count on starters that they've lost?
Well, I'd have to go through and look. I mean, it's got to be half at least. It's not necessarily the starters they lost. It's the stars they've lost. I mean, they've got some huge departures there. Their three best defensive players to begin with, and Willis and Justin Smith, and the one that I think really did them in, Alden Smith.
Yeah. San Francisco now, instead of Frank Gore, starting Carlos Hyde, a guy that you mentioned that they had hoped at one point would spell Frank Gore. That wasn't the case. In three games, in which he received 10 or more carries last year, he averaged 2.6 yards per carry. So while we expect to see a breakout performance from the running back on the other side of the ball, there aren't high hopes for what San Francisco can do on the ground.
Yeah, and it occurs to me now that I said Carlos Hyde earlier, I meant Kendall Hunter, because Hyde was still at Ohio State, obviously, back in 2012, when they were going to start splitting Gore's carries. But
well, I'm glad that we got that fix in.
Yeah, and yeah, it's a full circle editing job right here, and it saves our producer some time from having to cut up or find a snippet of me saying Kendall Hunter by accident somewhere else in the show and dropping and get in there. They obviously believe in Hyde, otherwise they would not have let Frank Gore get away. At least that's surface level logic. Now you could say they wouldn't have signed Reggie Bush and drafted Mike Davis in the fourth round either if they fully believed in Hyde, but. When they drafted Hyde, to me, he looked similar stylistically to Gore, just in appearance. Now, in his running style, that is. He's much bigger than Gore, or at least a little bigger, 6'0", 230. The question is, does he have the ability to get through small cracks on the inside? Because that's what made Gore so good, and that's what this running game was built largely around. We haven't seen enough to answer the question. I like Hyde. I don't, you know, his numbers maybe didn't look good in certain scenarios, but late in games last year, he was the guy that got the ball. It wasn't Frank Gore. They brought him in as the closer. He was their Ahmad Bradshaw, so to speak. I'm very interested to see him in a full-time role because I think he's the type of guy that demands 20 touches stylistically. The question is he good enough to warrant the 20 touches?
Yeah. What do you think about a sophomore of the year award? Because I'm looking at Teddy Bridgewater, and while I don't think that, you know, he ends up being a top 15 or top 10 quarterback in 2015, I do believe that he will make the biggest leap from that rookie year to the second year among all the guys that were drafted high there.
That's an interesting take. I'd have to go look at those first rounders again and think of who I would expect to make the biggest jump. Why do you say Bridgewater?
Well, last season, in his final six starts, and we can thank John Dangle, our editor and researcher, for putting these stats together before we sign off here. But in his final six starts, Teddy completed 68.9% of his passes, second in the NFL over that span behind only Tony Romo. I think things were starting to clip for him a little bit, just anecdotally, just watching that team. I don't watch it as closely as you do, obviously. But I think that, you know, if you add Adrian Peterson into that mix, things can only improve for him.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. And I brought up the first rounders now. I'm looking through them. I'll pick my sophomore biggest jump guy. It's not, I don't think he'll be the biggest jump, but it'll be perceived that way because he didn't get a lot of attention as a rookie. I'm going to pick Bridgewater's teammate, Anthony Barr. I actually spent today watching Vikings film, and Barr, he stood out all season to me last year. Physically, as a physical specimen, he has a chance to be one of the three or four best, maybe even the best, strong side linebackers in the league. Not just as a double A gap blitzer type, which is how they use him, but as a fierce run defender. I mean, Anthony Barr is an extremely versatile, gifted player. So I'll take him as my sophomore breakout guy or whatever we're calling this thing.
Well, that's our show. From Odell Beckham to Anthony Barr, that was your week one NFL preview. Please join us Thursdays at themmqb.com and on iTunes. Feel free to tweet at us using the hashtag. What's the hashtag?
The MMQB podcast. The editors get upset with us when we forget the.
Okay.
We are the MMQB podcast. Hashtag the MMQB podcast.
In any case, thank you again for joining us and see you next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.